I say that for the benefit of the guy at the back recording. So, good, thank you. You got the message, good. Mr. Armstrong, often wrote articles that were way ahead of their time. And I thought about this, frankly, during the royal wedding in London, because I remember a cover on the Plain Truth magazine shortly after the wedding of Prince Charles and Lady Diana in 1981. And I remember the royal carriage there with both of them in it. And the title of on the cover was Britain's Last Gasp of Joy and Splendor. And I thought about that when I was thinking about the fact that I had to write an article on the latest royal wedding. And I thought, that would have been a good title for the cover, but we can't use the same one that was used 30 years ago, so I've got to come up with another one. And really, Mr. Armstrong, of course, was wrong, because it wasn't Britain's last gasp of joy and splendor. The one last month probably was the last gasp, but even so, we still don't know that for sure. It's certainly more true now, though. I remember another cover story on the old magazine, it must have been at least 25 years ago, because Mr. Armstrong has been dead for 25 years. But another cover story was, prepare now to greatly reduce your standard of living. Now, don't be greatly impressed. I don't remember any other covers. But I do remember those two, okay, after reading the magazine for, about 20 years before Mr. Armstrong died. And, of course, that headline, that cover story, prepare now to greatly reduce your standard of living, I believe that is far more applicable now than it was 25 or 26 years ago when Mr. Armstrong wrote that. And I do remember he wrote that one not long before he died. The Financial Times, which I have a subscription to, had an article on the 26th of May, which said, the United States is now more likely to default than Indonesia and Slovenia in the next 12 months. So the U.S. is faced with a possible default. In fact, another article in the Financial Times, which I could not find when I was preparing this sermon, said that it's unbelievable. But here we are contemplating the actual fall of the United States of America, the greatest nation in the world. I've forgotten the exact wording, but that was in the article. The Financial Times is not the National Enquirer. It's not a newspaper that has trashy stories in it or wild speculation. It is, along with the Wall Street Journal, the most respected newspaper in the English language in the world. And if the Financial Times is talking in at least two articles about the default of the United States of America, then we are in serious trouble. And it's not just the Financial Times. The Wall Street Journal has similar articles as well on a regular basis. I gave a Bible study here recently on what it means to default. Our money would be worthless. We would not be able to travel to other countries. We would not be able to buy oil or coffee, which would change our whole way of life dramatically, just those two things. Never mind all the other things we would not be able to buy from the rest of the world, but there would be no coffee and no gas. In fact, we would not be able to buy and trade if we default. We would not be able to buy and trade even within the country, never mind with other countries, because if the currency collapses, then nobody wants it, not even Americans would want it. There would, in fact, be a total collapse if we default. Now, if you've seen any of the news this week, you'll know that Greece is faced with this right now. And what's happening in Greece has brought all of our pension funds down by about 5%. I heard that figure yesterday on NPR, that just Greece alone has brought our pension funds down, our retirement funds, our 401ks, have gone down 5% just because of what's going on in Greece. Greece is faced with a default, and people are rioting every day because the government has had to cut back on spending in just about every category. They've had to introduce austerity measures, and as a result of that, people are rioting because all kinds of things have been cut, all kinds of government programs. Yet, the Wall Street Journal pointed out this week that we are in a bigger mess than Greece. The United States situation is worse than Greece's situation. Debt is greater here. Debt is the primary cause of all our problems as a nation and as individuals. I had a conversation this week with a graduate who has a school loan bill of about $86,000. They have to start monthly payments next month. They just got a letter saying that your monthly payments have to start next month, and they will be $682 a month, which is, you know, roughly what a house payment is. You can rent an apartment for that, $682 per month. Now, you know, you can negotiate and get that figure reduced if you spread the payments out over a longer period of time. As this individual would like to get married and start a family, hearing the news of the $682 a month payment, severe depression set in. How can they possibly pay back the loans and live a full life, especially right now when jobs are scarce and pay is low? There was a survey taken of students just a few weeks ago that was on the news that showed the majority of students who right now are in higher education believe that it's just not worth it. Because at the end, you're not guaranteed a job. You're certainly not guaranteed a good job, but you've got loan repayments to make, which take a large part of your income. So the majority of students right now in our colleges and universities believe that it's just not worth it. That is a major change that's taking place in our thinking right now. School loans, mortgages, medical bills are the three main causes of the financial crisis that we're faced with, the debt burden that people have. Yet we do nothing about any one of them. You know, you file for bankruptcy, you can't get out from under school loans or medical bills, and mortgages you can, I suppose, but it's very difficult. But these are the three main causes of financial distress. Cal Thomas wrote an article which was in the Lansing State Journal on the 20th of May. The title was, "Ignoring Our Debt is Reckless." And the subtitle was, "Without Action, A Day of Reckoning is Ahead." Somebody sent me an article from the Guardian newspaper. If any of you want to read it, I'll leave it up here. The title is Decline and Fall of the American Empire. And this was just a few days ago. The economic powerhouse of the 20th century, the United States, emerged stronger from the Great Depression. But faced with cultural decay, structural weaknesses, and reliance on finance, can the U.S. do it again? And the conclusion is, basically, no, we can't. But it's interesting just to note some things here. It says that that America in 2011 is Rome in 200 AD, or Britain on the eve of the First World War, an empire at the zenith of its power, but with cracks beginning to show. The experience of both Rome and Britain suggests that it's hard to stop the rot once it's set in. So here are a few of the warning signs of trouble ahead. Military overstretch, a widening gulf between rich and poor, a hollowed-out economy, citizens using debt to live beyond their means, and once effective policies no longer working. The high levels of violent crime, the epidemic of obesity, addiction to pornography, and excessive use of energy may be telling us something. The U.S. is in an advanced stage of cultural decadence. That's the article in the Guardian newspaper. The Guardian at the end, by the way, of this article calls for something which I don't think is going to happen, but it certainly would be wonderful if it did for me and for many of you, and that is that there should be an amnesty for the housing market. In other words, just let everybody keep their houses, cancel all mortgages. That's not very likely to happen, I'll tell you that. But that's what they're calling for, because it's something dramatic like that has to happen in order for the economy to be put right. Anyway, we can look at that a little bit later on. Look at Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus 25. While you turn there, I've got to read you something that Antonio sent me just about a month ago. And it's quite amusing, but it emphasizes the point. It's from a newsletter called The Great Reckoning. I don't want to read the whole thing to you, but I extracted this much here. And the Great Reckoning is a very good financial newsletter. Comes out of San Francisco, and I think they've got people in Australia and London who also write for it. But it says that analysts say the punky figures are not confined to the U.S. You know, we're not the only country in trouble. The entire world is slowing down. Emerging markets are being forced to try to control inflation. Europe is worried about what happens when Greece defaults, which is coming soon. In fact, the Germans and the French had to meet yesterday to try and save Greece before it collapsed this weekend. The U.S. is suffering from the worst housing slump in its history. Prices are already down 33%. More than one out of four homeowners is already underwater, and prices are falling at the rate of about 1% per month. This latest bit of information is worth a pause. The total value of U.S. housing stock is about $20 trillion. Listen to some of these figures, because there's an amusing side to this. I found it amusing. Did you find it amusing? Okay, I'm glad. It wasn't just me. All right. The total value of U.S. housing stock is about $20 trillion. So a 1% loss equals $200 billion. So the value of our housing goes down by $200 billion. You know, that's 1% a month. That's $9 billion every working day. That's how much the value of our homes is going down. Now, say there are about 100 million wage earners. This puts the losses per day at about $90 per day per person. The typical worker takes home about $2,500 per month, by our calculations, barely more than he loses in housing prices. And here's another fact to toss in front of you this morning. In 1980, U.S. federal, state, and local debt per person declined at the rate of $2 per working day. As recently as 2000, debt declined again at the rate of $4 per day. But never have we seen anything like this. Government debt per working person is now increasing at $115 per day. Get that again. Government debt per working person is increasing at $115 per day. And that doesn't include the buildup in social welfare obligations. Add housing losses to government debt, and the typical worker, the typical worker's balance sheet is deteriorating at the rate of $205 every working day. The poor guy, he rolls out of bed this morning. By Friday evening, he's $1,025 poorer. How long can that go on? I mean, it's staggering when you hear it put in these numbers. So the question is, how long can this go on? Here's another thing. Seniors are supposed to be protected from inflation by COLA adjustments to their Social Security payments. But the feds compute the CPI as they choose, and they make their adjustments when it pleases them. The result is a big lag between the supposedly inflation-proof Social Security payments and the actual cost of living that old people face. According to a study done by a senior group, the post-65 population has suffered a real loss of purchasing power of 32% over the last 10 years. This is a serious situation. The average household is desperately trying to hold on to its standard of living. It has not had a real substantial hourly wage gain in 40 years. Prices are now rising faster than income, both for people who are working and for people who are retired. And those people who own a home are losing wealth collectively at the rate of about $200 billion a year. Actually, you should say a month. In a way, of course, this is good news. The whole point of the Great Correction is to wipe out bad debt, eliminate bad investments, and replace living standards, reduce living standards to a level people can afford. Anyway, that was a good article. We're looking at Leviticus 25. And verses 8 through 10, this is about the year of Jubilee when all debts were canceled in ancient Israel. This is exactly what is needed now, but it's not going to happen because as a nation we're not taking any notice of what the Bible says. Actually, over a year ago, or 2 years ago, Neil Ferguson, my favorite historian, who's an atheist, wrote an article on how we should do this in the United States now, have a year of Jubilee. And he's an atheist, but he knew about this. You shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement you shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land, and you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a Jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. So here is the proclamation of liberty once every 50 years, freedom from all debt. All debt was canceled. Those words are on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, and it's interesting, you know, when the United States broke away from England, a lot of people got out from under their debt because they owed money to British banks, and because of the rift, they got away with their loans. They didn't have to pay them back. And this is talking about money. That's what it's talking about. Freedom from debt. Because debt is very, very stressful. I was talking to somebody recently who, when I called them, they were watching a Robin Hood movie. And, you know, we had a little talk about it. And, you know, at the time that the Robin Hood left, of course, we think all the poor people were serfs. You know, peasants that were more or less owned by the lord of the manor, and you know, their lives were regulated and controlled by the lords. If you think about it, it's not that different today. Today, of course, it's the banks that control our lives. But most people are in debt. Not everybody's in debt, but most people are in debt. And when you owe a great deal, then your freedom to maneuver is very limited. Now, why am I speaking about this? Well, the reason I'm speaking about it is because here we are heading, it's like a train wreck. You know, we're on a train that's out of control. Did you all see that movie? I saw it about a year ago about the train that was out of control. I've forgotten what it was called. Unstoppable or something. Was that it? The title? Okay, good. My memory is not completely gone. Yeah, anyway, you know, it's like we're on a train that's, you know, out of control, and we're heading for a crash. And yet most people I know, including most people in the church, are not making any changes to their lives when we're faced with this reality. And this is why I'm speaking on this, because we need to make some changes in our lives in order to prepare for this. Now, I feel I would be remiss if I didn't mention it. We watched, a couple of weeks ago, we watched a PBS special with Susie Orman. And, you know, I didn't agree with everything she said on the program, but the special was very interesting because she made the point. She said all the thinking that, you know, we all had 10 years ago is now completely out of date. The way we thought about things 10 or 20 years ago. In fact, USA Today described my generation as the indecisive generation. Precisely because for the first 60 years of our lives, we were taught certain fundamentals. You must buy a house. It's your best investment. And it's the way to make yourself secure. You must save for retirement. These are the things we were told for 60 years. Now we find those rules are no longer applicable. The world has changed. None of those things works anymore. This is why we're called the indecisive generation, because we're not sure what to do. Because all the old fundamentals, the foundation upon which we built our lives financially, is totally different. It's been shattered. It's been destroyed. So, you know, in the first part of her program, she talked about how the worst thing you can do now is buy a house. The investment, investing in a house, you're going to lose. Now, if you've got the money, fine. She said that. She said, you know, if you can put 20% down and you've still got a minimum of $8,000 in the bank, then yes, buy a house. But if you can't put 20% down, and you don't have $8,000 in the bank for emergencies, then you cannot afford a house. Because any house you buy, even now when prices are down, you're going to lose. The average person is going to lose. You might luck out if you buy a foreclosure, you do it up, you might still make some money. But most people will lose. In fact, one article I read in the Wall Street Journal pointed out that this is the biggest single fact about the future of the housing market. There are over 100 million baby boomers in this country, and sorry everybody, but we're all going to die soon. And when we die, our homes are going to be sold to Generation X, whose numbers are 41 million. Now, if you've got over 100 million houses on the market and only 41 million purchasers, what's going to happen? The value is going to go down. And there's no reason in logic why house prices will not go back to what they were in 1932. And that was an average of $500 per home. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm saying that, you know, there's no reason in logic why it can't happen. Because, you know, we're dealing here with, you know, economics and economic trends which are just not predictable. You can't predict anything. Nobody's got a crystal ball. All you can predict at this moment is we're in trouble. And that trouble's only going to get worse. So we have to start making adjustments in our lives to prepare for the fact that things are going to get worse. Each generation has to do a rethink. Depression-era people, people who lived through the Great Depression of the 1930s, were hardworking. People who lived through the Depression also ate everything on their plates because they didn't know where the next meal was coming from. And they also were hoarders. Some people wouldn't throw anything out. When we lived through Ghana's financial collapse, the default that Ghana went through, even empty bottles were of value. Even grocery bags, which were not available in Ghana, if we brought some grocery bags back from a trip overseas, they were of value. Nothing was thrown out, nothing at all. Even when we put bones out for the dogs, people came by and sucked the marrow out of the bones. Nothing was wasted. That's the way it was in the 1930s. And again, there's no promise that we won't go back to that. Baby boomers thought that life would continually get better and better. And they also assumed they were in control of their own financial destiny. A new generation is going to have to adjust to declining expectations and hardship. I can look at this from my own life because I grew up in the north of England shortly after World War II, and the country had not recovered from the Second World War, as a result of which there were shortages of things, and you know, most people found it very hard to make a living. First of all, everything, all transactions were in cash. There were no credit cards back then. And when my children hear about this, you know, it's like, oh, this is ancient history. It's not ancient history. I am not ancient, you know? It's not ancient history. In actual fact, the way we lived in the 1950s was pretty much the way everybody had lived for hundreds of years. What's happened since the 60s is we discovered credit, and our economy boomed on the back of borrowing, basically. People borrowed. Everybody's been borrowing. The banks have encouraged us to borrow, but it's a false prosperity. And the fact is now a lot of people are in serious financial trouble because they borrowed so much. And the reason why everything's collapsing is because we've reached the maximum limit of the potential to borrow. There's no more money to borrow. We as a country have been borrowing roughly 75% of all the world's wealth and living off that money. We can't do it anymore. So we're going to find it's just not going to be possible, or not as easy anyway, to borrow anything in the future. But back in the 1950s, when I was growing up, everything was cash. You know, we did not always know that we were going to have a meal at the end of the day because, you know, finances were very tight. And every month, my parents struggled to pay the mortgage. That was the norm. That was normal. In fact, it's normal for most of the world today. You know, I sometimes get, don't know what word to use, but it can be rather amusing in a way, you know. We all obsess in the United States, well, not everybody, I'm sure some of you don't, but many of us obsess about our weight. When I go to Ghana or South Africa or anywhere else, you never hear the word diet. It's a joy to be in those countries. You never hear the word diet. Diet, people, if it does come up, people will laugh. Diet is an American thing. Because we have so much to eat and so cheaply that we can easily put on weight. Most of the world struggles to put a meal on the table. So they don't care about diets. They just want to eat. They just want to live. And in a way, we've lived extremely well. I'm using that as an analogy here. We've lived extremely well. And things are going to get tougher. They already have gotten tougher. And we're finding more and more members in the church are struggling financially as a result of some of these trends. There was an article in the Lansing State Journal just over a week ago, the 1st of June. Minimum wage not enough in Michigan, the article said. The study that was done by one of the universities here, I've forgotten which one, showed that some families need three times the minimum wage just to survive. By the time you factor in all costs, housing, food, daycare was even included in this, people need at least three times the minimum wage just to survive. So, you know, the minimum a family needs, according to this article, according to the university study, was about $52,000. That's what a family needs in order to survive. So what's ahead? The Wall Street Journal had an article on the 24th of May, the return of stagflation. I've got the article here, the return of stagflation. I'll just read you the first couple of paragraphs. Stagflation is an ugly word for an ugly situation. Persistent high inflation combined with high unemployment and stagnant demand in a country's economy. The term was coined by British politician Ian MacLeod in a speech to Parliament in 1965. We have not experienced it here in the United States since the bad old days of the 1970s. Yet with prices on the rise and unemployment still high, the U.S. economy again seems to be entering a period of stagflation with no end in sight. So that's what we're faced with, which means Mr. Armstrong was right 25 years ago. We've got to prepare now to greatly reduce our standard of living. So let's have a look at some biblical principles on financing. Look at Proverbs. Begin in the book of Proverbs here. There's a lot in Proverbs about money, because money is a major concern to all of us. The book of Proverbs, chapter 1, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding. This is the book of Proverbs here. Chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. So, you know, Proverbs is here for our benefit, to help us to become wise, to make wise decisions. Proverbs 3, verses 9 and 10. Honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase. So your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. You know, this is telling us to, you know, put God first. And when it comes to our finances, to remember God, honor the Lord with your possessions, realizing that everything comes from Him, and with the first fruits of all your increase. So, you know, the first tenth belongs to God, is what that's reminding us. So your barns will be filled with plenty, so that God will continue to bless us, and your vats will overflow with new wine. Malachi chapter 3, of course, has a verse that I'm sure you're all familiar with, about how nations can also have serious financial problems because they've turned away from God. In fact, all of our financial problems as a country are directly due to turning away from God. I'll explain that in a moment. It's not just that we don't tithe as a nation. There's other factors too. In verse 9 it says, "You were cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that they may be food in my house. And try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. It's not just that as a nation we've turned away from God's law of tithing and we don't put God first, but the reason why we've got our serious financial problems is because we have destroyed the family system which God gave to us. That's the primary cause of all these problems. In the 1960s, for example, in 1965, you had the introduction of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. And the plan was that, we should take care of all of those who were less fortunate. So, for example, single mothers. The nation has a responsibility to help single mothers because otherwise their children grow up disadvantaged and then they're resentful and then they start rioting. Or they start stealing, they turn to criminal activity. So therefore, we need to help single mothers. Of course, what that did was lead to a lot more women choosing to be single mothers. So the bill has risen every year. There was a very good analysis of this by an African-American writer who showed that Lyndon Johnson's well-intentioned idea to help single mothers actually has made things worse for African Americans. Because right up until 1960, the number of African Americans married to each other, living with their children, was roughly the same as the percentage of whites living in a marriage with children. But after the law changed in 1965, rapidly the numbers, the gap widened because so many African American women realized they could get more on welfare than they could get from their husbands. So they kicked the husbands out and went on welfare. Now, I've mentioned this before, and I hear it occasionally. You know, my youngest daughter's a nurse, and many of the friends that she has are single moms by choice. And that I've heard before about the benefits you can receive when you're a single mother. Free accommodation, free education, free vehicle, and other things, just by having a baby out of wedlock. So we've actually encouraged it. And, of course, the bills have mounted up every year. And then, of course, free medical care is another thing. Now, it's not just single moms. I mean, there's all kinds of welfare programs and other government programs as well. They have all led to our national bankruptcy, to the point that now every single family in the United States, if all the debts that the government has were divided equally according to every household in America, each one of us would have to come up with over $500,000. It's staggering. I mean, how can we possibly do that? So we're in a very serious situation. Now, let me just say here, I'm actually on the more positive side than most people, because I believe that God wants us to do a work again. So I do believe that he's going to give us some time to do that. And that requires the economy to remain solvent. So I'm actually quite positive. So if I sound negative, understand that I feel actually quite positive. I think we are going to come through this. I think it's going to be at the last minute that there will be some sort of an agreement patched up to help us get through this. But I believe it's going to happen because I believe God wants us to do a work. Having said that, every single one of us needs to do some things to put our financial houses in order. And, some of us are not really facing the reality of what could happen. Look at Proverbs 27. You know, one of the good things about tithing is that it helps you to prepare a budget. You have to, really, to have a budget. I had a phone call from somebody yesterday who was telling me that his best friend is about to lose his house. And he said that this person who's married with three children has lived a very nice lifestyle and just has everything he wants. They don't hesitate. They just put it on a credit card. Well, now they've got to the point where paying off the credit cards each month costs so much money that they can't afford the house payment. So they're about to lose their house. Well, you know, I'm sorry, but they've had a few years of warning about this. Why is it that people haven't changed their habits? I think about this every time I go to a restaurant. Because typically when we go to a restaurant, it's full. And I think, you know, the country's in a terrible state. A lot of people can't afford some of the basics, and yet everybody's still going to restaurants. And, you know, all the research shows that a restaurant meal costs 14 times, on average, what it costs to prepare the same meal at home. 14 times. So you could cut your food budget by, what's that in percentages? I don't know. By, you know, a lot. if you ate at home. Of course, it's nice to go to a restaurant, but can we all afford to go to a restaurant? When I grew up, my family couldn't afford a restaurant, so we didn't go to a restaurant. Proverbs 27, verses 23. Be diligent to know the state of your flocks and attend to your herds. You see, you've got to know exactly what your financial situation is. And many people don't. One of the first things financial advisors will tell you to do is for 1 month, for one calendar month, keep a record of every single penny that you spend. And I mean every penny that you spend. So if you buy a newspaper, you put it down. If you buy a cup of coffee, you put it down. You write everything down for a month. And then at the end of the month, you look back and see where all your money has gone. And you'll be surprised. You'll be shocked, actually, at how much money you spend on things that really are frivolous and are not helping you towards your ultimate goals. Be diligent to know the state of your flocks and attend to your herds. So that's a principle there. Know your financial situation. For riches are not forever. The wealth that we've had over the past 30, 40, 50 years is not forever, it says here. It has depended upon debt. It's been built on a false prosperity of debt. And, you know, now we're going to reap the whirlwind. And even though I do believe that something will be patched up this summer to try to help this country avoid a default, nevertheless, I don't think it will avoid it forever. It will avoid it as long as God wants us to do work, basically. But eventually it's going to come. For riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations. In other words, a country and a political system does not last forever. I don't know if you remember the guy Francis Fukuyama, who is a Japanese-American. He wrote a famous book about 20 years ago called The End of History. He said, history is over, we don't have to learn it anymore. It's really a stupid idea, but anyway. He said, it's the end of history because the whole world has realized the best system of government is democracy, and now every country will want it, and then we'll have peace forever and ever. And when I read this, I thought, what a stupid man coming out with that comment, and what a waste of money it would be to buy the book. But anyway, he was interviewed again recently in the Financial Times, and I did read the interview. And he made an interesting observation. You know, he basically admitted he was wrong, although he didn't use those exact words. But he said, now, he said, there is a growing realization all over the world that democracy does not work. It cannot solve our problems. That's rather chilling. You know, that's what happened as well in the Great Depression and led to fascism, Hitler and the others. And he said, that's what people are realizing now. Democracy doesn't work. And so his thinking was that our political system is not going to last. In fact, you know, one article I read pointed out that the basic problem we have is with our political system. It doesn't work anymore. I mean, some of our politicians are more busy exposing themselves on the internet than they are, you know, trying to solve the country's problems. It's really quite pathetic, some of the things that go on. But it doesn't work like it used to work. So that is a problem we've got. But anyway, this is telling us to get get a grip on our finances and to know exactly what our situation is. Look at Proverbs 22. Proverbs 22 and verse 7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. The rich rules over the poor. the borrower is servant to the lender. This is a warning against debt, to avoid debt as much as possible. You know, the only debt that we've got is our mortgage. And I don't want any other debts. And I was talking to somebody recently who was contemplating just walking away from their home. We both agreed that at our point of, in life, at our age, doing something like that, which affects your credit rating, it doesn't really matter anymore, because I don't want to borrow anything for anything ever again after what's been going on the past few years. So I think a lot of other people are going to start and think the same way. I don't care about my credit rating. I just want to get out from under debt. So you're going to see more and more people walking away, not just from their homes, but from other debts as well. It's often been said about dieting, nothing tastes as good as thin feels. Well, when it comes to money, nothing you can buy is going to make you feel as good as having money in the bank. It's the same thing, really, as dieting. Nothing you can buy is going to make you feel as good as having money in the bank, having some savings. Don't confuse wants and needs. Look at chapter 21 of Proverbs. In verse 17, he who loves pleasure will be a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not be rich. So, if your primary pursuit is pleasure and a high lifestyle, you're going to end up broke. Today we would have to say that this applies to things like cigarettes, alcohol, eating out, entertainment. I met a guy up in Edmonton, has a good job, earning about $100,000 a year, smokes a pack a day, $12 each day. Can you believe that? And the Canadian dollar now is worth more than the American dollar, so that's about $13 for a pack of cigarettes. And so we figured out that's over $400 a month just to smoke. I don't know what he spends on alcohol and other stuff, but it's just staggering how much people spend on some of these things. Chapter 25, there's some more biblical principles on these things. Chapter 25, verse 28. Whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls. Again, self-control is what it's talking about here. Control your wants. Which, again, is not always easy. You go to a restaurant, you want to eat all the best things that they've got, which usually cost a lot of money. You need to exercise some self-control. The same with drinking and everything else. Just be careful. Chapter 24. There's other areas too. There's things that we can easily cut out. Again, there was an article in the Financial Times that one of the biggest single business developments in the United States at this time is the number of people getting rid of cable and also getting rid of their landline, because these are two things that can easily be cut out, and the two of them together can easily save you $100 a month. And that's what a lot of people are doing, getting rid of cable and getting rid of their landline. And it's not just a question of living within your means now. It's a case of preparing for the fact that things are going to get more difficult. And so you've got to think a year or two ahead and be prepared, rather than try to do everything when it's imposed on you. Chapter 24 through verse 3, through wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established. So what this is saying is, take a long-term perspective to fulfill your financial goals. By knowledge, the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. I'm trying to get this through to my kids. Save for everything instead of borrowing to get everything that you want. Save for it. You'll have far fewer headaches and less financial problems. And, again, I emphasize, this is the way it was until the 1960s. Until credit cards enabled everybody to buy what they wanted even though they didn't have the money to pay for it. But until that time, you had to save for everything. In fact, one of the saddest things about the Great Depression of the 1930s was this. A lot of people had saved up the money to buy a house. The average cost of a house was $500. And then in 1932, a lot of banks went bust, and they lost all their savings. So the house they had saved for, maybe for 20 years, they lost it before they actually had it, because the banks were wiped out in 1932. That's one of the saddest things. But you couldn't borrow to buy a house. That was something that was started in the 1930s. As a result of what had happened, that is what started. That people were able to borrow money to buy houses. And what triggered off this crisis that we've got is the fact that people were maxed out when it came to their mortgages. And now we understand things. For example, the banks were actually encouraging people to borrow far more than they could afford. I know when we were looking for a house, I qualified for a house that was roughly twice the value of the house we did get. And I think now, wow, if I had bought that, we'd be in a real big mess. But that's what the banks routinely did, because, the guys that were selling these mortgages made a commission. So if they could get you to borrow $500,000 instead of $200,000, they made more money. And the fact that this might actually ruin your finances didn't bother them at all. The fact that it might force people into foreclosure didn't bother them at all. They got their commission, and that was it. Immediately, they'd forgotten all about you and who you were. So a lot of people got into big financial trouble because of this. So this is saying, through wisdom a house is built. Take your time. You buy the land first, and then when you've got the land, then you start building the house. You take your time, one step at a time, but always do it in cash. One reason why Indians from India are doing so well in the United States is because they operate solely on a cash basis. They don't borrow. It goes against their culture. So, it's often joked, there's a lot of Indians in England. We have quite a few here now, but in England there are whole neighborhoods which are nothing but Indians. And people will tell jokes or stories about Indians and Pakistanis, very similar in the cultural outlook on this. You've got five families living in one house. And some people will be doing shift work. So they rotate the beds, three people sharing one bed, one for 8 hours here, one for the next 8 hours, one for the next 8 hours. And people will joke about that, but they do that to save the money to buy a house or start a business, rather than getting into debt. And now, of course, they're coming out ahead because they've got the cash and we don't. So, sometimes we can learn some things from these other cultures. Debt, you go through the Bible, do a study on debt. Look it up in a concordance, and you'll find nothing good is said about debt in the Bible. So why do we borrow all the time to try to get whatever we want? Because we want it now. That's the problem. I really can't stand commercials, not most of them anyway. Occasionally you get a funny one. My granddaughter loves the ad. I think it's for Geico with the pig that's squealing all the way home. And she wants me to find it on YouTube and play it to her all the time. She loves that commercial. But most commercials I don't like. But I do notice when I see commercials, I notice phraseology that is used. You owe it to yourself. You deserve it. Things like that. Those phrases are used because a lot of people fall for it. But if you haven't got the cash, you don't owe it to yourself. In fact, you can't afford it. So just, quick forward through the commercials and don't let them influence you. Go down to chapter 13. Again, another proverb here, chapter 13. One thing to realize is everybody's going to make mistakes in the financial area. We all have. And it says here in verse 18, poverty and shame will come to him who disdains correction, but he who regards a rebuke will be honored. So, you know, don't be afraid of listening to somebody else, of getting advice from somebody else. Now realize, by the way, if you want to talk about this, a very good person to talk to is Len Martin. Now, we're not likely to see Len Martin coming here to Lansing again, certainly not on a regular basis, because he's been hired by the church and sent to the New England, which is like, you know, the Siberia of the church. It's up there, isolated from everywhere else. But Len Martin has been a financial advisor for years, and now he's working for the church. But he'll tell you that, you know, you really can't trust any financial advisor because they live off commissions. So they're naturally going to want you to do this and do that, buy this, buy that. And this makes it very problematic in making the right decisions. So good to give him a call sometime if you have any questions on this, because he will give you an honest answer. The verse 18 here says, poverty and shame will come to him who disdains correction. Those who don't learn from the mistakes, those who won't learn from what others say, the end result will be poverty and therefore shame. But he who regards a rebuke will be honored. I was explaining to two of my children yesterday, we're having coffee together, and or in my case, tea. And, you know, I said, you know, really that we're going to have to relearn some of the ideas that culturally were dominant in the early part of the 20th century and the late part of the 19th century. For example, one of the most popular books of the Victorian period on both sides of the Atlantic was Charles Dickens's David Copperfield. Very popular book. And there's a character in David Copperfield called Mr. Micawber. When David was a young boy and was sent to work, he stayed with the Micawbers. And Mr. Micawber was always having problems with debtors or creditors, those that he owed the money to. And Mr. Micawber gave David some advice when he was being led off to prison. Because back then, if you got into debt, you went to prison. Now, if you get into debt, they send you offers for more credit cards. So it's very different to the way it was 150 years ago. But back then, in the United States and Britain, you went to prison if you could not pay your debts. And you had to stay in prison until your family paid off the debts for you. In fact, Dickens wrote a whole book on a family that lived in debtor's prison. Only the man had to stay there all the time. He was the prisoner. The rest of the family went out each day to earn the money to pay off his debt. Dickens himself actually grew up in a debtor's prison. And you can still see this debtor's prison in London. I've never been there, but apparently you can still see it. But anyway, Mr. Micawber's advice to David Copperfield, I gave it to my children yesterday, was this. And I adapted it from the English currency to the American to emphasize the point and to get the point across. I said, if your annual income is $50,000, and your annual expenditure is $45,000, the result will be you will live a happy life. If your annual income is $50,000 and your annual expenditure is $55,000, you're going to live a miserable existence. That is so true. Because any debt puts you through a lot of stress. And the only way to avoid it is to make sure you live within your income. But our culture in the past 40, 50 years, our financial system, has encouraged us to live beyond our income. And the average family has spent more, roughly 10% more than what it earns each year, borrowing against the equity they had in their homes. And we can't do that anymore because the home values are coming down. And so, you know, people don't have the ability to spend. And this is why people are not spending like they used to. But you have to work out a budget. So if your average income is $50,000, you don't spend more than $45,000. Because As Susie Orman said, one of the first things you do is you pay yourself. Now, actually, she said that is the first thing you do. I would say the first thing you do is make sure you tithe, because you want God, you want to work with God when it comes to your finances. But the second thing is to save, which means pay yourself. And paying yourself 10% is a good idea. So you take that out of your income before you plan the rest of your budgeting, and then you'll find. In many cases, people are finding, and you know, this young person I was talking to was finding that with the school loans and with everything else, they can't afford to get their own house. Which is why, of course, a lot of young people today are living at home with mom and dad, because they just can't afford to get their own place anymore. Things have changed since the 1960s. Look at chapter 12, just a couple more scriptures here, and then we'll finish. Chapter 12, verse 11. He who tills his land will be satisfied with bread, but he who follows frivolity is devoid of understanding. There's a good principle there, and that is work hard. you know, if you're going to goof off all the time, you'll never have anything. Verse 24, the hand of the diligent will rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor. These are general principles here. See, some of these principles, in a way, they don't apply the same way today. Because you could say this about most Western countries. You know, verse 24, it doesn't apply anymore. The diligent do not bear rule. They just pay more in taxes. Whereas the lazy ones receive the benefit of those taxes, the welfare. So, a lot of these principles have been forgotten. Our ancestors understood these things. And our societies were built on this. Those countries that, followed the Bible to the best of their knowledge and understanding. Again, if you look at the Victorian period in the late 1800s, from 1837 to 1901, that's the Victorian period. Whether it's the United States or Britain, basically both countries were built on the principle, if a man doesn't work, neither should he eat. That's in 2 Thessalonians, that's one of the verses that Paul wrote. If a man doesn't work, neither should he eat. And I had to actually enforce that on my congregation in Ghana. Because when we lived through a famine in Ghana, I bought some land so that everybody could grow their own food. And some people refused to. They said, well, I can't work on a farm. You know, I've got a shirt and tie. I work behind a desk. You know, I'm not going to work on a farm. I said, well, if you don't want to work, then you're not going to eat. Biblical principle. So they had to get out there. If they wanted to get any benefit from all the farming that was being done by the other members, then they had to contribute as well. And that's a very good principle. And it's something good to teach our children too. One of the things Susie Orman mentioned, which I think is a good principle, and that is, don't teach your children, don't pay your children, young children, to work. Because they need to learn that as family members, they should contribute anyway. You know, they should be learning to contribute. And I think that's very sound advice. Chapter 11, verse 3. The integrity of the upright will guide them, but the perversity of the unfaithful will destroy them. So, you know, we need to do things God's way when it comes to our finances. Verses 24 through 26. There is one who scatters yet increases more. So be generous with what you've got. You help others, you'll find that you increase more in your wealth. There is one who withholds more than is right, but it leads to poverty. Those that are miserly may end up with nothing. The generous soul will be made rich, and he who waters will also be watered himself. The people will curse him who withholds grain. The blessing will be on the head of him who sells it. So those who withhold grain to speculate, to drive the price up, the people will curse them. The blessing will be on the head of him who sells it. And then finally, chapter 30 of Proverbs, chapter 30. These are all good principles to study and to think about. Verse 7, two things I request of you, deprive me not before I die. Remove falsehood and lies far from me. And then give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food allotted to me, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. I find this scripture very interesting. You know, it's you don't want wealth and you don't want poverty. Poverty is miserable. And if you don't know where the next meal's coming from, you know, life is really depressing. But at the same time, wealth alienates people from God. And I'm sure this is the reason why God gave us the year of Jubilee, because it canceled out all debts. But it also meant the wealthy, of course, who had loaned out all the money, they lost out in the year of Jubilee. It was, to use an expression, a great leveler. It brought everybody back to ground zero, to start over again. There's a lot of wisdom in that, because great wealth is not good for people, just as poverty is not good for people. And this passage of Scripture is saying that. And remember Solomon, who inspired these words and spoke these words. You know, Solomon was extremely wealthy. But remember, Solomon accumulated his wealth through high taxation. And when his son took over and increased the taxes, it led to a rebellion. And that's how the kingdom was divided, and you had the 10 tribes leave and form the separate kingdom of Israel. One other thing I might mention, and this is advice being given. I heard this up in Canada. The federal government up there is advising that. And I saw this something written in the United States as well a while ago. And that is to stock up on essentials, 6 months' supply of essentials, preparing for worsening circumstances. Now, the advice is given in the U.S. primarily because of the prospect of terrorism or the prospect of us all losing internet connections and telephones, etc. So it's more like a survival thing. But the Canadian economy, which has been doing really well, you know, they are also advising this, that every family should have 6 months' supply of essentials. The Mormons advocate a year. My eldest daughter always says that if the crunch comes, she'll find the nearest Mormon family and just go over there and live with them, because they've got a year's supply of food. Her neighbors were Mormons, but they've moved now, so she's going to have to look further afield. There are many more proverbs that deal with personal finance, but these are a start. The most common error that people make is getting into debt, simply because our society encourages it. And, you know, sad to say that many people, including many in the church, will not cut back on overspending, will not make the economies that are necessary to be made. And this is something that we all need to do, make those economies before it's too late. And final words, as has often been said, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail.